you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. It is time to begin the Tech Net, which has existed since September 1982, 36 years ago. So for almost every one of those Sunday nights since then, the curious radio amateurs get together and teach each other the art and science of wireless ham radio technology. About 26 different kinds of ham radio. The one you're listening to right now, 2 meter FM repeater, is just one of the 26. And if for some reason it doesn't please with you, before you give up the hobby of ham radio, try some of the other 25. Yeah. The books do a mediocre job of teaching RF technology. The classes people take do a mediocre job, from my point of view. If you really want somebody who understands radio, you hire a ham radio operator, a guy who's got a passion for the subject, has been touching it, feeling it, dreaming about it for years. He's got hands-on experience, and that's something that many books and schools and professors cannot supply. At the college level, radio is taught by way of the so-called Maxwell's equations, and although they are the foundation for it all, it's too many steps back. It's not in the form of useful engineering information. The people who really build antennas and transmitters and receivers rarely go back to Maxwell's equations. They use a whole bunch of rules of thumb that they've learned through their experience, through the apprenticeship. If you want a radio operator, you need a good one. You need a 10-year apprenticeship under the wing of somebody who's been there and done it. Let me drop one. That's a bunch of opinions, but not too many people will challenge me on those opinions. The TechNet itself is broken up into roughly 3 sections, not necessarily of equal size, depends on enthusiasm. The first section, people sign in with their name and call letters because they do have a question or a comment for the net. We take those in order, and the group helps that person answer his particular question or accepts his particular comment. You need that sign in because you're listening. After 36 years, we believe there's somebody there listening. It doesn't have to be proven anymore. By way of Echolink and IRLP, there are people who sign in from pretty far and wide, other states and occasionally other countries, Canada in particular, occasionally Mexico. That's the first section where questions, answers, and comments. The second section is usually run by Dr. Roy AC2GS. Has a section called Science Talk. And so what recent things have occurred in science, in particular radio science, he brings to our attention. The third section is run by Paul WS2N, the Space Report. So he tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and all the other worldwide space agencies, what they're doing, what the next launch will be, and what to look out for. So that's our menu. Let me drop. Each time I pass it over to you, try to remember to not squeeze the mic immediately. Wait for the 4 beeps. All of the IRLP and Echolink of the system has to be reset. And if you pick up immediately, there's a good chance you're going to drop out because the machine has something like a 1.5 minute timer. Let me drop. The repeater itself tonight has a problem that Eric KE2EJ, our repair maven, is working on, so you'll occasionally hear bursts of noise in the background, which is what you're hearing right now. And most of the time we can hear the audio above that, but we're going to be putting up with that until Eric gets a chance to fix that one. So at this time we're going to take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters, your name, the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. Try to remember to wait for the 4 beeps before you transmit. K2RIW, check that. I'm out for listening. Bob, your signal was extremely noisy. I know that your name is Bob, and you're Kilo Delta 2 something. If you give us a little bit more power, a little bit better antenna aiming, if you're doing it on a handy talkie, move to a slightly different location, please give me your call letters. Kilo Delta 2 question mark, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
November Victor Bravo, Bob, Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo, extremely bad, I can switch to echo.
Bob, go ahead.
That's correct. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Correct.
Okay, Bob, we got you. You are 85% noise, 15% audio. So with earphones and you're repeating, I'm able to hear what you're saying, but to ask the question, I think you said you could sign in by EchoLink. You may have to do that. Okay, we've got Bob. Anyone else check into the TechNet with question or comment? Give me a call, letters, and name right now after the four beeps. K2RIW. Is there another person trying to sign into the TechNet? Please give me your call, letters, and name right now after the four beeps.
WS2M with a question.
Okay, we got Paul as our second sign-in, WS2M. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call, letters, and name right now. I heard a very distorted KD2 blank. Sounds like Kilo Delta 2 something. Want to try again? Speak a little softer. Maybe you were overmodulating. Or maybe you're 5KC or frequency. I think you're overmodulating because each time you talk, you're getting a dropout. I think I heard VJB, but I'm not sure. Please give me the call letter's name, K2RIW.
KD2PKA.
Okay, you got it that time. Is it Kilo Bravo 2 or Kilo Delta 2, Papa Kilo Alpha? So correct me on the call letters and give me your name. Go ahead.
Kilo Delta 2, Papa Kilo Alpha. The name is Jay.
Okay, we got you loud and clear that time, Jay. So far we've got Bob, Paul, and Jay. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now. Maybe we'll have a later sign-in. Bob, I hope you're able to sign in by another means because your signal before was extremely noisy. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo, K2RIW. You've got it, Bob. Okay, I think I'm going to be able to copy you. Give it a try, Bob. Go right ahead. Bob, if you were attempting to sign in, you didn't make it at all. So the other technique you have by which you can get into the repeater, it's time to go to that other technique. I'm going to pick up Paul, and we'll come back to you. So I'll pick up the next person who signed in. Paul, WS2M, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Paul.
Okay, I'm copied. I hit the wrong button here. WS2M.
You're sounding good tonight, Paul. Please proceed.
Okay, I was just wondering if you got the picture that I sent. Roy a picture and you a picture about this antenna that's in Rock Cosma. There's a couple of them in my area, the telescopic antennas. I'm just trying to figure out what they are. And, maybe you know what they are. They have apparently chained to a pole so you can't take it. And some kind of a, looks like a power supply or something going to it. What have you seen that? Back to you, Dick.
My first question, Paul, is when did you mail this to me? I'll go back in my records and see if it's there. I don't remember seeing a picture from you in the last few days. So how long ago did you mail it? And you probably used my QRS, ARL email address. What would you for the answers to that one, Paul?
Okay, maybe you didn't get it. Yeah, I think I hit the reply instead of reply to all from AC2GS. You probably didn't get it then.
Okay. You could mail it to me now, and I'll pick up the next person and come back to it. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I'll give that a try.
Okay, let's try one more time with Bob. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. Have you found the other way to sign in tonight, Bob? If so, go right now. KD2NVB, K2LIW listening. Okay, we're batting 1,000 here tonight. Jay, we're going to go over to you now. Kilo Delta 2, Papa Kilo Alpha. Go right ahead, Jay, with your question or comment. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Good morning. Yeah. I was just wondering, if I have an HF antenna and a UHF-VHF antenna, does it have to be separated by a certain amount of feet or something so it doesn't affect any of the other radios? Or can they be within a couple of inches of each other?
If you're smart enough, they can be within a couple of inches of each other. But if you're doing very general work, a foot or so is usually enough. Particularly if, say, for instance, you're combining a 6-meter Yagi, a 2-meter Yagi, a 432 Yagi, a 20-meter beam, they can be stacked on top of each other with a fraction of a foot of spacing. As you bring antennas like that close together, the first thing that happens is that the shorter elements, like say for instance I've got a 6-meter antenna mounted above a 20-meter Yagi, a 6-meter Yagi. As I bring the two close together, the tips of the elements of the 6-meter Yagi see the nearby metal of the 20-meter Yagi. It adds capacitance to the tips of those 6-meter Yagi elements to get tuned to a slightly lower frequency. That's the major interaction between. Other than that, there is essentially no interaction between the antennas if they're on a different band. So the stacking distance for antennas can be ridiculously close if they're on a different band. If they're on the same band, that's another whole story. People make the mistake of calculating the effective capture area of each antenna and make sure that these capture areas, which are usually a circle, do not touch each other or don't overlap very much. People usually make that calculation to calculate stacking distance. That is an extremely severe calculation technique that's 99% in error. Let me explain to you why. That 20-meter Yagi, in this particular case, has some amount of forward gain because of the Yagi process. In other words, you've got a reflector, a driven element, and a director tuned to a very specific frequency. The director has got to be a certain percentage of higher frequency than the driven element, and the reflector has to be a certain percentage tuned to a lower frequency. The 6-meter elements alongside of the 20-meter elements, the 20-meter elements do not even see at the slightest interaction from the 6-meter elements. The 6-meter elements see the nearby bigger piece of metal, and they get a little bit of tuning to a lower frequency. But the effective capture area doesn't exist on the other frequency. If I measured the capture area on the 6-meter frequency of the 20-meter Yagi, it would be much, much lower than a dipole. It's a very small effective capture area because it's not tuned to that frequency. So therefore, this idea of calculating the effective areas and making sure that they don't overlap is much too severe. So if people are using these techniques that I'm describing, stacking very, very close and getting away with it. The best example I can give is that an antenna that was popular in the 1965 timeframe called the Senco 62-meter Yagi. Senco manufactured and sold a Yagi. We're on the same boom. It had 6-meter elements and 2-meter elements on the same boom, and the antenna worked beautifully well on each of those bands. It can't get any closer stacking than that, than being on the exact same boom, where the length of the 2-meter elements were slightly readjusted because of the nearby 6-meter element gaining some extra capacitance. I'm trying to think now of an experiment I ran along this...
Repeater, timeout.
So the bottom line of all this is that as long as they're on a different band, you'd be amazed how close you can get. Now, where people really worry is the fact that 2 meters and 432 are harmonically related by a 3-to-1 frequency region. So people are afraid to stack a 432 Yagi on top of a 2-meter Yagi because of the 3-to-1 relationship. Again, you're being much too severe. Now, if I take the 2-meter Yagi and measure its gain on 432, it's an extremely small number. And correspondingly, if I take the 432 Yagi and measure its gain on the 2-meter frequency, an extremely small number. So even though they're harmonically related, the tuning is all wrong, the capture areas are not there, and don't worry. So the only place where you'll run into a little bit of a problem is because a receiver is an extremely sensitive thing that can listen to a signal that's a small fraction. The receiver can listen to a signal that's a small fraction of a microvolt. So that if you are closely stacking, let's say a 2-meter and a 432 Yagi, and you're transmitting on 432 and you want to simultaneously listen on 2 meters, there will be, because of the close spacing, enough strong 432 signal getting into the 2-meter receiver that it probably will create some receiver overload, and vice versa. So if you want to transmit on one and receive on the other without using some good fancy filtering, you will get some receiver overload. But other than that, the ridiculously close spacings have been done by many an amateur. You'll find articles claiming that you should stack them by the overlapping areas. And some very respected people have written that article thinking that's the right way to go. Good sounding common sense, when you get down to the physics of what's really going on, it's dead wrong as I see it, Jay. KD2, and by the way, which particular bands and what kind of antennas are you intending to stack? KD2, PKA, KQIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick, wait for the beeps.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I was going to put, was it 70 centimeters and HF together, and I just wanted to see if it would be a problem. And also, is it possible to only run like one coax and put like hook them together so that you only need one coax coming out, or each one needs a separate one?
The super conservative approach would be a separate coax to each one. That gives you all kinds of ways of transmitting on one, receiving on the other. The next step to make sure that they don't interfere with each other is you can buy a duplexing filter. You can buy a kind of a filter assembly where the transmission line at the top of the tower goes into this filter assembly at the common port, and then the filter assembly has a 2-meter port and the other frequencies. Let's say, for instance, a 2 and 450 or a 2 and HF. Buy the right kind of filter assembly. From the common port, it'll have very low loss on each of those two frequencies, but it will not mix them up. So you can buy the right kind of a duplexing filter that can do that. The only other way to do it would be a broadband power divider. But the broadband power divider will, by definition, have at least 3 dB of insertion loss. It's feeding half the power to each antenna, so to speak. So the right way to do it is with a filter, the right kind of a duplexing filter. They're a little bit pricey, and I don't know what brand name I should recommend, but with a little bit of search, you'll find these things. A well-designed filter will have a small fraction of a dB of insertion loss on each of the 2 or 3 frequencies. You could even buy a triplexing filter, a filter that takes a common input from one coax and splits it to 3 separate antennas on 3 separate bands. That's also doable. So that's one way of doing it with one piece of coax. Back to you, Jay. KD2PKA, K2RIW. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, thank you. I think I got it. I got to check it out. I'll probably just run two separate cables. This way, it'll be all right. So thank you. This is KD2PKA. We'll be on the side listening.
Yeah, you can start off with two separate cables. And at a later time, when you buy the right filter, you can use one cable to both antennas, and the other cable can go to a third antenna, so to speak, or another experiment. So there's lots of ways of going. Okay, looks like I did get the picture that Paul mailed to me. I'm going to take a look at it right now. In the meantime, once again, we're going to try to pick up Bob. Bob, Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. If you're able to get through, go right ahead. K2RIW, you got a problem.
And there's two pictures on that email, Vic. WS2.
Roger. Paul, that antenna is a metallic structure alongside of a utility pole. Is the antenna itself approximately 15 foot tall, like a vertical of some kind? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that was my guess, about 15 feet, you know. I was standing next to it. It's over twice my height. And it is telescopic. And there's a bunch of these things at different intersections throughout my area. So you can see they have it. It's all temporary. So they've got the thing chained to a pole. And then there's some kind of a box that they have near the bottom with some kind of, I'm not going to call it a coax connection. It looks like a real metallic flex connection. It might be coax inside of that. You know, maybe, it's definitely a flex connection. But I can't figure out what it is, so and they've magically appeared. I've seen at least three or four of them.
Paul, is there a chance that flex connection is a piece of semi-flexible hard line? The black box, looks like it's about a half a cubic foot box. And it's wrapped around the pole. Is it powered in some way? Do you see power going into it, or do you think it's battery operated? So where's the power coming from that's going to that black box that's got a cable feeding the base of the antenna? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it looked like it was being powered. They have a line that comes down from the pole. It's attached to the pole, so you're probably pulling the power from that pole area, you know. It's hard to tell. That's what I was thinking. So I think it's powered, and then there's, you know, and the power might be actually coming through that flex connection. Maybe it's doing dual purposes. Maybe it's feeding power and, I can't imagine it being an RF connection, because the radio itself would be inside this black box. So I think that flex connection is just like a power thing. That's what I think.
I think these are appearing in your town, Ronkonkoma. Are they at particular intersections? How many have you seen? How long ago do they appear? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, this one's right on the border of, Ronkonkoma, Wisconsin. In fact, to the right of that is 911 Memorial that we have here. So there's one there, and there's another one probably about a mile away from that, at another intersection, and then another one near Veterans Highway on a different road. And at first I thought, well, maybe some kind of temporary cell tower, cell connection or something for the fire department, but I don't think so. Could it be receiving signals of cars going by, counting cars, instead of running the rubber tubes across the road? I was thinking maybe it's counting cars. Don't know. Back to you then.
If you're using it as some kind of a proximity detector to know when cars are going by, you wouldn't need a mast that big. You wouldn't operate it at such a low frequency. The size of that mast, if that's the thing that's doing the radiating, suggests that it's on a low HF frequency. The base of this thing had a piece of cable going into the black box, which may be his hard line. Did you see anything that looked like ground plane radials? Or maybe the cable is going into the base of this tubular antenna, and maybe it's feeding the upper half compared to the lower half, and there's an insulator somewhere in between, but I don't see it. So when you look at the base of the metallic tube, do you get any hints as to what's going on there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
C2GS.
Yeah, maybe going on. Yeah, it's, I took another picture, but I can't really tell. Roy, pick it up.
Yeah, Paul, thank you. I think that it's just an extension mast. There seems to be an object wired in at the very tippy top. It looks almost like one of those old reflexive incandescent lights. But if you follow the pole all the way up to the end, the wire goes out, goes into a receptacle, and there's a small conic section of something going on there. So I don't think the long pole is the radiator. I think there's something going on at the very end.
Unusual. And that sign, I can't quite read the sign that's on the pole. What does the sign say, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, whatever that is. That is no nothing to do with this. You know, people put advertisements on a sign. I'd have to blow the picture up to get a better look. See what it says. You're a real estate. You want to sell your house? They'll fix it up and flip it for you. You know, one of those. Yeah, it's got nothing to do with it. But if I blow that picture up near the top, like Roy's talking about, it's some kind of a... I was thinking some kind of a clip at the top just grabbing the wire. And I'm thinking, it looks like it's not ABS plastic, but almost like the same stuff that conduit is made out of, like a PVC type of conduit that the electricians use. It looks like that type of material. And I'm thinking a wire, you know, running up the center of it. That's what I'm thinking. Back to you, Dick.
WA2VDH with a comment.
VDH, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, I have noticed that on Sunrise Highway in the Baldwin Freeport area, they are putting up some type of UHF microwave connection between the various traffic lights. I see at several intersections what looks like mounted up on a mast, looks like a small patch antenna, which is beamed at the next intersection, and apparently some type of information is being passed between the various traffic lights. I noticed that several intersections along Sunrise Highway, both in Baldwin going into Freeport. Go ahead.
John, the patch-like antenna you're talking about, a VHF antenna, is it mounted to the utility pole? Is it mounted to a separate mast? What is it mounted to? Go ahead.
There's usually a length of mast that's attached onto a utility pole and goes up, about 4 or 5, about 5 feet. And then this patch antenna is at the top, and it's usually pointed at the next intersection or the next traffic light, maybe about a quarter mile away or so. Go ahead.
Thank you, John. Paul, the top of this 15-foot mast, I can't tell from the photograph. Are you saying there's something coming out of the top of the mast? It doesn't just end with a round bulb of some kind? Over to you, Paul.
When I look at it in person, it looks like just a stiff wire, like a loop, but as I blow the picture up, it looks like there is some kind of a thing there. Maybe it is looking at another antenna or something. But yeah, they seem to be at intersections where street lights are. So, I don't know. I'll have to look further into it. And if that's true, then this mast is really doing nothing except giving this thing that's at the top some kind of height. Maybe there's a coax type of wire on the inside of this telescopic thing. Telescopic mast. Well, okay. Back to you, Dick. The mystery will eventually be solved. I'll find somebody out here that might know something about it.
Yep. Coming out of the top, you said there is a stiff piece of wire, which you think is a loop. Are we talking about 14-gauge wire? Are we talking about a 6-inch diameter loop? Describe the loop that you saw on the top of the mast, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's probably, maybe 14, probably 12-gauge, a little thicker. But, again, I can't really tell. Let me bring it up on a different computer. Maybe I could get a better look.
Okay, so it's a piece of 12-gauge wire. Is it in the form of a loop? And what diameter is that loop? And is the plane of the loop perpendicular to the ground or parallel to the ground?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it up on the computer. Better computer. Give me
area at the top as though it was designed to maneuver the horn antenna into a position.
You two doubled and Paul went out. So, Roy, please repeat your message.
It appears to be a loop of wire. There is a thickened area at the top. Might be insulated. Can't tell really from the picture. And it almost looks like it's a device to position the horn antenna in a certain location rather than any other thing. It could just be a loop of wire that's coming from the mast into the core of the horn antenna, which I assume that that's what it is. But it could also be a positioning device.
Roy, are you saying you did see a horn antenna, or you think you're seeing the mounting for a horn antenna? That's not clear. Go ahead.
If you trace the image all the way up to the top, you see something that looks like a little horn antenna to me. I mean, it's a side profile, so it's difficult. It could be, sometimes there are floodlights that have that type of a shape as well. But the fact that it's positioned so high, I doubt that they want to spotlight something. So I'm assuming that it's some kind of a horn antenna, but it's a conical device. It's hard to say if it's metal or plastic because it just looks gray. So it might be, but it looks like to me.
Interesting. Paul maybe has brought it up on his second computer. Let's see what Paul has got to say. WS2N, K2RIW.
I should hold the camera differently. The top is being taken out by the title, what I titled this thing. I really can't see it. I have a third picture, but this one's not bugging either.
You probably have answered this question before, and I've already forgotten. How many of the installations have you seen? Is it 2 or 20 of these you've seen? And are they all in your town, Ronkonkoma? Over to you, Paul.
Well, I've seen 4, and one officially is in Wisconsin, because it's across the street from Ronkonkoma. So, I really can't see the top properly. I'm going to go back, maybe, take another picture during the week. It's a busy road, so I park in a parking lot and walk on the sidewalk. When there's no traffic, I go out and take a picture. Otherwise, the way it's lined up, you just don't get a good picture with that pole in the way. Get another shot. Well, maybe I'll go to a different antenna. I'll try a different antenna.
How long ago do these things appear, Paul? Is there any correlation that these things are located at the... at the red light camera locations? Over to you, Paul.
These are not red light
corners. So I would say within, definitely within the last 2 weeks, maybe, you know, less than that. I'm on these roads all the time, so probably within the last 10 days.
It's a mystery. We'll eventually find out, because there sure appears to be a piece of radio equipment of some kind. And we being interested in radio, we're eventually going to find out what it is. Going to make one more try for Bob. Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo. You were able to find a way to get in, Bob? T2RIW, over to you.
One quick comment that I just wanted to mention. I'll look at it real close, but, you know, a lot of police are always at this corner. And I'm going to make sure I have my license with me when I start looking at the, see if I can find some wording or something written on the box.
Yeah, that's worth a try. The box might have a manufacturer's name and number and things like that. The mast itself somewhere might have some markings on it. And wiggle the wire. Is that a piece of semi-rigid hardline? It looks like it could be, except that it's got a funny right angle bend in the middle of that line between the black box and the base of the antenna. Am I seeing that picture correctly? Over to you, Paul.
You are, and it's about the same size of RG8U. I think it's just powering that box. I think the electronics are in that box. Everything is self-contained within that item. And, you know, within the box, the telescopic piece itself, you can see they've got a chain to the poles that isn't going anywhere.
I think you said from the top of the pole you saw a power line coming down to the black box. And then the base of the black box has this sort of semi-rigid coax going into the base of the telescoping mast. Is all that true, Paul?
Yeah. Well, I think he sees a wire coming out, but it's a little tricky. You're looking at the power wires above it. No, there's nothing leading from the top going to anywhere. It's all self-contained. The only wire exiting this thing is coming out of that box, and I think it's just a fancy power wire, but I can't say for sure.
AC2GS.
Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, a couple of points. Bob texted me his question, so we can get to that when it's his turn. In addition, I made a zoom of the of what looks to be a horn antenna to me, and I sent it on email to both you and Paul. And Chris, one of our listeners, sent me email that said they might be gunshot listening and triangulating devices for the police. They're putting them all over the place. If you fire a gun, it hears a certain frequency from the shot, and they instantly have the exact location of the shot and dispatch police. So that's Chris's additional comments on the subject.
So fun. Yeah, that's, I see it. Very good.
Yeah, because sound travels roughly 1,000 feet per second. Depending on the timing of when each one of these devices picks up the sound of the gunshot, you can pinpoint the location, the origin of the gunshot, I think, in most cases, to the nearest house. So that's another good guess as to what it could be. And I know that they've installed quite a few of those in the town of Brentwood, and looks like Ronkonkoma is now getting them. There's a fair number of firearm events occurring almost every day in Brentwood. Is there anything at all like that in Ronkonkoma, Paul? How often do you hear of a gunshot in the town of Ronkonkoma? WS2N, K2RIW.
Since 1979, zero. Never. No. Closest thing to that is fireworks on the 4th of July. But I think this could be some kind of a sound detector. And from looking at the picture Roy sent me. So I wouldn't be surprised. You know, and maybe these are a test, you know, these antennas, I'm going to call them antennas, but really a mast with a probably transducer or something at the top. Probably a test, and maybe they're going to see how it does. and maybe eventually make permanent installations. I mean, you can't leave this as a permanent installation. This is probably temporary.
By way of that zoomed-in picture you mailed me, Roy, that looks like an acoustic device. That's not a radio microwave horn. The flare angle of that horn is much too wide to be a typical horn design. I think that's an acoustic detector. That's what it looks like. And the acoustic detector now picks up that signal, gets sent down that mast into the black box. And then how in the world does the black box transmit the signal downrange? Anybody got any guesses on that, K2RIW?
A VDH with a comment?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I've seen a number of the shot spotter detectors around my area here. Usually they are mounted on light poles, and they have a plug to draw power. It looks like they take their power right from where the photocell is on top of the light pole. And usually there is a little Yagi, a vertical-oriented Yagi. Looks like it's around the area, would be cut for around the 1 gigahertz range, somewhere in that area. Yagi that sends information back to the central monitoring point or the headquarters, where they then do the calculations to find the gunshot location. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Yagi being so 1 gigahertz sounds very reasonable. 902 to 928 megacycles is a region, a license-free region, depending on the method of modulation. Yagi itself, does it look like a green printed circuit board Yagi here? Over to you, John.
Well, the only thing I can see, it is a vertical-oriented Yagi. The ones I've seen look like they have about maybe four elements or so.
Each of those four elements, are they on a boom in air, or is this a printed circuit? At 900 megacycles, it's very convenient to make a Yagi on a printed circuit board. NWA5VJB sells an awful lot of those for functions like that. Back to you, John.
Oh, no, these are definitely on a boom. This is definitely on a boom. Go ahead.
And each of the elements on that boom, do they look like they're about 4 inches long?
That sounds about right, yeah. It sounds about right, about 4 inches. Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Then a good guess is that's on the 902 to 928 megacycles, set a 915 megahertz license-free band. As long as the power is kept under 1 watt, as long as the antenna gain is kept under 6 dB over isotropic, and as long as the system is doing frequency hopping, no licensing of any kind is required. That's the frequency region where RFID, a high percentage of the domestic RFID readers and tags operate. So that's a couple of good guesses. So right now I guess we're thinking acoustic detector and microwave link to some central location. And right now the one that Paul has given us a picture of, maybe there's a battery in there. We don't see any photocells. So right now it's mysterious where its energy is coming from to support the operation. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's probably being powered. I don't know if it's a battery. It could be. I guess you wouldn't need much power to run this thing. But, I mean, there's definitely a coax, some kind of connection at the bottom. I'll get a closer look at it maybe tomorrow.
Okay, sounds good, Paul. Who is the person that was about to sign in? Please pick up K2RIW. Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. Are you there, Bob? K2RIW.
This is AC2GS. I have Bob's question if you want it.
Fire away with his question, Roy.
He writes, his question is about getting a loud hum through his stereo system. He likes to run the radio through the headphone jack, and when he transmits he finds that he gets this hum. It occurs on 2 meters, but not on 440. So he's looking for some suggestions of how to get rid of the 2 meter hum on his radio when he tries to use it as a amplification portion of his radio.
Okay, what is the source of the signal? What's the radio that's picking up that signal? Earphones are connected to what? And once again, under what conditions is he getting hum? So I got a bunch of disconnects there as to what's the source, what's the radio, and is the hum only there when 2 meters is transmitting? Over to you for the repeat on all of that, Roy.
Hey, Dick. I just kind of read what he wrote, but let me try and figure some of the things out. I think what he's saying is that he likes to listen to his radio through the amplification circuit of his stereo system. So he plugs in the headphone jack of his radio, and I don't know what model radio he uses, into his stereo system to listen to it. But something seems to happen when he tries to transmit on 2 meters, he apparently gets some kind of feedback in his stereo system that he's using as a general amplifier for his radio output.
I might indicate to you, Roy, that 30% of the time we're getting crashes of noise on your signal. We're hearing your audio above those crashes, but the crashes are only a couple of dB weaker than your audio. So this repeater is it's in a pretty noisy mode tonight, and that's one of the things that Eric is going to be fixing in the next few days. I had the impression from what you said that the amplification of his stereo system for the signal coming out of a radio and then coming out of the great big speakers of the stereo system works correctly when he is not transmitting. And when he turns on a transmitter, he's getting a hum. And a good guess is that RF pickup, in other words, the transmitter, some of the RF signal out of the transmitter is a good guess getting into the stereo system. When RF energy gets into the stereo system, the PN junctions of your transistors start becoming rectifiers, which is one of the puzzles that you've used on your Kings County Radio Club technical net, that the RF energy being picked up by a radio circuit, a modern-day transistorized amplifier, can get rectified and change biases and do all kinds of crazy things. So the next step is to find out how the radio signal is getting into the stereo by moving it around, by moving the transmitter, by powering it from a different outlet, moving the power supply. There's all kinds of ways you can find out where is the point of ingress, and by way of ferrite isolators and bypass capacitors and so on. Let me drop this. With rare exception, almost every single situation of radio frequency interference is a curable situation with proper filtering and bypassing and locating and orienting and so on and dressing the wiring. So by moving around wiring, by changing where the power supply is located, by changing what the wall socket is used to power the equipment, by changing everything you can think of, and noting whether or not the amount of hum increases or decreases, by holding a piece of metal nearby to act as a shield, by putting a ferrite isolator around the audio cable that comes in from the radio. There's a whole bunch of tricks you can try, and by divide and conquer, step by step, you'll eventually find out which one makes some kind of a change, whether the change is an increase or a decrease of the hum. It's giving you a clue as to where the point of ingress is coming from. AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it right.
Thank you very much, Dick. I agree with you. I would probably go for the quick and slightly more expensive method of finding a very nice RF shielded powered speaker system and using that instead, which is kind of what I do personally.
I leave radio, stereo receivers in my living room, and I get nicely RF shielded speakers for my shack.
In some cases, just a simple 1,000 picofarad bypass capacitor across an audio input line could make a huge improvement if RF is being picked up. In other words, the audio cable coming from the radio into the stereo could be the thing that's coupling in the radio signal, if you know what I mean. So, because he likes the loudspeakers of his stereo system, it's probably giving him some nice round sound where he can adjust the amount of treble and bass and so on. I can see why he would like to keep using the current system. I know with a little bit of effort there's a way he can definitely keep using the current system and eliminate the problem. As I've said, past experience has shown that if you have enough smarts and you know what you're doing, essentially every single situation of radio frequency interference is a solvable situation. There's only one or two places the signal is getting in, and there's a zillion ways you can stop the signal from getting in that's creating the grief. It might even be, there's a slim chance that the wiring between the loudspeaker and the stereo is acting like the antenna that's coupling the radio signal back into the stereo. There's even a chance that that's taking place. Again, a 1,000 picofarad disc ceramic capacitor between each one of those screws at the back of the stereo to the chassis might make a huge improvement, if that's what it was. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2RAW.
All that is very good suggestion-wise, by the way. He added in Echolink that he has an IC7100, which I own as well. That's my backup radio that I used for many times when we were trying to figure out where the dropout was happening to me. So it's a very fine radio. I haven't had any problem that he's had, but, you know, it might be as simple as a capacitor. It might be as simple as a ferrite choke. Some stereos are just not well RF shielded. They weren't particularly well designed for that happenstance, because most consumers don't usually wash their receivers in, you know, 10, 20, 30 watts of radio frequency signals. So I wish Bob luck. I know Bob well. He's a member of my King County Radio Club. He's a regular of my Kings County Radio TechNet, so I hope this helps him.
Okay. Roy, is there any way you can increase the RF amplitude going into the repeater tonight? When the burst of noise comes along, it's almost equal in amplitude to your audio. So anything you can do to increase your RF strength would be helpful, because other than that, when you do your science talk, we're going to be missing some of your words. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Be better.
You just asked me, is this better? And I think the answer is no, I think it was worse.
Is this any better?
You didn't give me enough audio to be sure, but I'm not sure it is very much better if it is.
Okay. Is it any better now?
That last transmission was noise-free, but because the noise comes at an intermittent period of time, we're not absolutely positive yet. So that last transmission was quite good. Let's hope it continues. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
The problem we're experiencing is poor isolation in the duplexer. And, actually, I haven't had a chance. What I really should do is turn the output down and repeat it and reduce the detesting that's going on, but that's what's happening. Because of the motor, you know, it drops out of one receiver, picks up another receiver, and that's why it makes it sound worse. Because it'll be noisier into the receivers that are further away. K2RW, K2GAN.
Is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
Yeah, I heard you doing some testing with Eric a night ago, Eric. And when you turned on and off the transmitter, you did sense the fact that there was receiver desensitization taking place. So when the isolation is not good enough and the front end overload is occurring in the receiver, that means you're in let's say 1 dB of compression. So 1 dB of compression means the receiver has a non-linearity, which means it's now acting as a mixer. Therefore, all other signals that are on the top of that building with you in Glen Oaks are capable of making intermods in your front end. So that descends. And the randomness of the blast of noise coming and going is depending on what other transmitters are being turned on at that site. That's what I think is going on. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and I guess you're about to do a fine-tuning of the duplexing, Paul. Go ahead.
Actually, I'm getting another one to put up there just temporarily. Well, I'll take that one down and go over it with a fine-tooth comb and set up a three-port version of the Vector Network Analyzer, which I can actually do and do it right. The only thing is that really should be situated in the bandpass filter for that way, as far as the duplex is concerned. The loads, which is in theory supposed to be 50 ohms, will be close to what they actually are in reality.
See, I had a comment I was going to say to you, Paul, and all of a sudden I forgot it. Oh, when you get that duplexer well-tuned, do you have a guess as to how many decibels of isolation you're getting between the transmitter and the receiver for you, Paul? Is it a four-cavity or a six-cavity duplexer?
It's got six sections and it's all rectangular. I don't know. I think that the mechanical structure of this duplex is what shifts a little bit. And, I should be getting like minus 90. I bet we're doing like minus 70, minus 60, something like that.
If I take your transmitter power and knock it down by 70 dB, that's a fierce amount of power to come into the receiver front end, from my point of view. You'd like to have a lot more isolation than that if you can get it. Is the duplexer up top in a constant temperature, constant humidity environment, or is the local weather making the conditions go up and down in temperature and humidity? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, it's just indoors. I would say that because the proprietor of the state, to conserve dollars, he tried to swing about in the summer to let it come up as high as like 85-90, and in the winter it'll get down to around 60, somewhere in that neighborhood.
So I think you're saying that your experience is that this duplexing filter every 2 years or so has to be touched up because it drifts out of its ideal isolation tuning. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I seem to be experiencing. Although most of the other duplexes I've really dealt with have not had to deal with that. We got that to replace a big monster, which was actually four cavities, but a lot of tunes, a lot of adjustable stuff.
Yeah, I think a four-cavity duplexer is cutting it a bit close for your particular very severe environment. I think you told me you've got another standby duplexer already tuned up to the right frequency, or can be tuned to the right frequency, ready to go. And if that's got six cavities, I would consider it. I think four cavities in that environment is cutting it too close, is my guess, Eric, go ahead.
Well, it's got notch filters all over it. Actually, when you tune it upright, that four-cavity Sinclair really comes about, you get as good as minus 87, minus 90 in that neighborhood. It's the problem with it, it was really nice duplex, but the problem with it is that the harness itself was getting to be, like, really old,
and that was changing, and the capacitive tuning stubs on the end was getting brittle and kind of falling apart, so it was time to replace it.
Understand. Okay. The next step of improvement